we will realize that these faults and these virtues are still functioning within ourselves, just as surely as they did in the age of Pericles. Tradition, therefore, tells us a little about how a life should be lived. It tells us whom we respect. After several thousands of years, who do we remember out of the past? For whom do we have gratitude and appreciation? Whom do we regard as universal benefactors? And we will generally find that we will honor those most who gave us the greatest internal securities, who gave us the greatest dreams, the most beautiful and wonderful hopes and aspirations, and also gave us codes which have lived and still continue to exert a powerful force, and that these codes are not obsolete. And when we say the code is no good, we really mean the people haven't lived it. It is not the belief that is wrong, it's the person who fails to use that belief. And if a generation turns away from traditional knowledge and gets into difficulties, this does not mean that traditional knowledge is wrong. Nothing that is true is wrong. Nothing that is useful truly to the unfoldment of the human being can be rejected. The second point of the problem is experience. It was said not long ago by one individual that when you are working with a stubborn person, do not try to convert him, leave him alone, and let his own mistakes convert him. You can't talk him into doing something he doesn't intend to do. Let him do it. If he's wrong, he's going to find out himself, and nothing can prevent it. So experience is the continuous application of convictions to conduct. It is the continuing effort of the individual to find out the best ways of doing things. Experience tells him what he can do. Experience will tell the doctor how to teach a patient better manners and better ethics. Experience will teach the mother how to give greater discipline and proper leadership to her children. Gradually, experience tells us how to stay well, how to stay happy, and how to remain useful throughout the entire span of existence. Only experience. And when our conduct does not produce an experience effect that is commendable, then the time has come to give it more consideration. Now, all experience teaches us that the wiser and better and more intelligent we are, the greater our chances of security. Experience also teaches us that many fabled beliefs and many ideas that have been popular will not work. Experience is always the final proof of the pudding, which is the eating. Experience is the problem that comes to us every day. And it was for this reason that Pythagoras made such emphasis upon the importance and the integrity of watching the consequences of daily experience in conduct. Daily experience gives us the skill to determine that which is useful when the time comes and we need that information. The third instrument is experimentation. Once we do a thing and it works, this may or may not be conclusive evidence, but if a series of actions always will produce the same result, or a series of experiments in a laboratory will always come out to the same effect, then we may say that we have discovered a fact. And facts are rare things, not easy to discover. But wherever experimentation justifies, opinion must be changed. We cannot live by opinions. We cannot be happy with opinions. A wrong opinion will always undermine and destroy us in the end. We may think for a time that we have something wonderful, but if it is not supported by experience, if it is not proven by experiment, and if it is not justified by the traditions of the race, we are liable to be in serious trouble. Now, in the form of learning, what is the best learning at the moment that we can think of? Well, I suppose it is the kind that we have in short supply at the present time, and that is philosophy. Philosophy was the guide of antiquity. Science is the guide of the modern world. Philosophy, however, is a bridge. The purpose of philosophy is not to justify itself. It is to reconcile man's spiritual and material needs. It is to bring the superior and the inferior into harmony. Philosophy proves or justifies religion and produces various distinct and definite media for the expression of integrities. Philosophy, therefore, helps the individual to live according to the best part of his own life. One of the Greek philosophers was once asked by a father what the advantage would be if his son went to study with a philosopher. And the philosopher replied, well, if you do that, if you do let your son study with a really learned man, there will be an unusual change in the boy. For instance, when you go to the Circus Maximus to see the games, if your son has been taught by a philosopher, he will not be one stone sitting on another. Which meant really, of course, that the stone benches, that the boy, without knowledge, without wisdom, without insight, was little better than a rock. So philosophy has as its purpose to demonstrate the values of life, to help the individual to live a good life. Everyone must have some kind of a philosophy. Atheism is some kind of a philosophy. It is something by which the individual receives the incentives to a certain area of conduct. Enlightened philosophy is that which impels the individual to live as nearly as he can in harmony with the essential demonstrable truths of life. And this we have very great need of today. We need more people who have a more or less philosophic background, one in which they have found benefit from experience. So the next thing is to take a good look at the experiences in your own life. If you can remember back to early childhood, you can begin to estimate the effects of things that happened to you. Maybe when you were 5 or 6 years old, something happened that you didn't understand. Something hurt you. Something injured you in one way or another. Now, from a standpoint of maturity, you can estimate the significance of that. I know several cases in which a person, having passed through an unfortunate or tragic circumstance in early life, has carried the hurt of this all the way through to the present time. They have always rejected something because it reminded them of the hurt. They have always held a grudge against a line of life, a race, a nation, or an environment, simply because they suffered there. There, time and time again, prejudice arises from an experience that has not been assimilated or has not been transmuted. We must all transmute experience into soul power. We must all try to find ways to prevent things that have happened to us from distorting our attitudes toward life in general. We must do everything possible to overcome an animosity, to get rid of a jealousy, to sublimate a hatred. We must realize that every destructive attitude which we continue to hold will ultimately destroy us. Now, it may be that of our own thinking, we can overlook this. We can say, after all, it all happened long ago. The persons involved are dead, and why should we continue to worry about them? But if the prejudice has already been locked in the subconscious, it will not die with the person with whom it was associated. It will continue to live. It will be a ghost in our own lives until, by a personal and conscious action of the will, we remove it. Now, we can say, how do we remove a grievance? After all, you can say it's not there and it's still there. You can pray to be delivered from it, and chances are you won't be. You will say, I forgive the individual, but you don't really. The grievance sticks because it has become part of the subconscious mind. Also, it sticks because we have no way of forgetting it. If we could forget the past, we would find certain experiences would fade away. But unfortunately, we would be further impoverished. It is not the experience that is forgotten, but the experience that is understood that is important. So what do we have to get out of our grievance? The only way out of the grievance is to transmute it into experience growth. The only way we can get over a grievance is to find out what it taught us and be grateful for the lesson. If it didn't teach us anything, then it has been a failure on our own part. If we can say, I don't see any good I ever got from this misfortune, then you have to look further, because you have had some good. You have had some good even if it took 50 years to come around. Because perhaps this day, when you for the first time question the grievance, this is the beginning of the good. But gradually, and with a little experience, we can discover in most instances that we were party to the misfortunes that have afflicted us. Our own attitudes were wrong. We tried to do something that wasn't strictly ethical. We tried to take advantage of someone else. We depended on someone else for things we should have done ourselves. And gradually, little by little, we become a party to the problem that hurt us. I know there are a good many cases in which, for example, marriages have gone sour. And after it's all over, the individual could do nothing but complain against the marriage partner. Impossible person. Oh, no one knows what I've been through with that person. Oh, it is unbelievable. And then at the very end comes a cute line. Well, of course, I really didn't love him in the first place. This was the answer. But the fact that this was the real answer, it doesn't always show up. And we have to work for it. We have to dig into ourselves and find the answers. We have to realize our own part in the misfortunes that have faced us, or that we have faced. And by so doing, we gradually come to learn to use the mind. We use it constructively, and we transmute disasters into opportunities for personal growth. And we learn from mistakes, and we learn how all kinds of strange prejudices and pressures within ourselves affect conduct. If we live in a little world of business and television, we'll never find these things. We have to begin to look further, to go out into the larger sphere of knowledge. We have to learn to watch other people and see how they are affected by their own conduct. And we have to realize that we also people. And when we see someone in trouble for a certain attitude, we can say to ourselves, do I have that attitude also? Or am I headed in for a disillusionment? So by degrees, we gain all these attitude changes. Now, there's another point, however, that we should also carefully remember. And this is one of the most difficult sometimes to get around to. And that is that in our effort to improve ourselves, we must not stew in our own juice. We must not become constantly self-centered. We must not, under any condition, devote our whole life to trying to understand ourselves. It becomes too burdensome, and for the most part, we don't have the working tools to make a successful job of it. So in problems where it becomes obvious that we need ventilation, the best answer to this is to get into new activities, get away from self, get our minds off of what we think about ourselves, and become more and more concerned with basic evidences of self-improvement. Therefore, it is very good to have these avocational outlets, which will permit us to take the pressure of our own constant involvement in our own attitudes. So we can say that each person should have at least one or two significant, meaningful, useful avocational outlets. They should do something, create something. If they are in business, then the outlet should be creative, because it must compensate for that which is a more or less sterile daily burden. If, however, the nature of the person is highly artistic, and they have featured that all their lives, then it is more likely that they will need social stability, that they will need to develop stronger moral integrities, and that they will find it important to be more practical in their daily living. The artist, therefore, may find it good to go into social service work, or something working with young people, something to get the individual out of his own field, but into a compensating field to balance his own intelligence, so that he is working with a new group of faculties within his own mind. It is also very important that these faculties should be constructively used. I know a case of a person who, for many years, was a housewife. No more, no less. Always, however, down in the depths of themselves, they had a desire to create something, to be creative. When the children grew up and fortunate financial situations made it possible, this individual went strongly into art and divided their attention between the development of artistic potentials and the direction and guidance of social service projects. The person went on into very advanced years, busy to the very last with things that were meaningful. They had a wonderful time. And at the same time, they could still cook a good meal. It didn't destroy the domesticity. Now, here's where we have some trouble sometimes. The tendency in professional life is to gradually destroy the family. The individual who is in business, and if all the members of the family are employed, the home is the sufferer. Gradually, the development of the personal relationships are damaged. Everyone should be faced throughout life with personal relationships. To escape them entirely or to avoid them because they are uncomfortable is a serious limitation upon growth. We must not only live with ourselves, we must live with other people. And we must live with people we do not entirely agree with. We do not necessarily, however, have to accept unpleasant situations as completely endurable. But we must try, to the best of our abilities, to maintain a balance. What we need to do in substance is to keep our faith in God and our realization of the divine plan of which we are a part. To have this realization of a plan and a planner, a purpose and that which proposes purposes, we have to have a sovereignty of a divine power established in wisdom, love, and strength, upon which we can depend if we are worthy. But that this power will not break its own laws to give us comfort and pleasure when we're wrong. The presence of a divine principle justifies the realization that life is significant, and that life is something we shouldn't waste. That life is not fulfilled by simply going to school, raising a family, having a job, and dying. Life is a series of adventures, of experiences, and every moment of life should be lived, not thrown away. Among older people especially, this sort of waiting for the end and making the journey as comfortable as possible is a mistake. These people should be doing things that they have not done, but which should be done. If they have been in business, if they've had various responsibilities, they should go into opposite areas and develop new talents, new abilities, new courage, new interests. And where they do this, they have a wonderful time, because I know many that have done it. This, therefore, is the realization that we are here for a reason. And we are here to prove our own growth, improve ourselves, and contribute to mutual benefit for society. Having decided in our own minds that we're here for a reason, then we each have to decide what the reason is. Now, each person probably has a little different reason for being here. We all are here because of previous activities. We are paying old debts and making new ones. We are going through all kinds of experiences due to faculty specialization in our own mind. Therefore, we have our own reasons for what we do. But there is no just reason for doing nothing. There is no reason by which wasting time can be justified. Time is an opportunity to strengthen either the strength that we have or create new strength where we had weakness. Time is an opportunity to grow, and all growth is measured in time. And to waste time is to waste life. So we try to find ways to make life interesting. And by interesting, we mean that it must have a varied pattern. It must be composed of circumstances which we can look forward to, changes that are benevolent and useful. So to build a plan with a future that is going to be fulfilled to our own contentment and progress, this type of thinking is very valuable. Actually, therefore, in philosophy, we gain the courage to recognize that the divine power within us is going to be rationalized into conduct, and that this power has within itself two tremendous factors. One is the power of life, and the other is the power of death. Wherever life is abused, death is hastened. Wherever life is improved, the probabilities of life being lengthened are good. And those to whom the lengthening of life may not be the final answer will find that self-improvement goes with them beyond the grave. Whatever progress we make is permanent and builds into our eternal natures. Time we waste is meaningless. It is simply a delaying of the maturing of our own lives. And very few people need that kind of delay. What we've got to do is to correct it. So with philosophy, we begin to understand the reasons for things. We justify right. We prove why it is right. If we say to someone, I believe in kindness, we can say, I believe in it because of the Bible. I believe it because Christ taught us to be kind. Or other world teachers have taught us to be kind. But we can also approach it philosophically. We can prove with very little effort that kindness is one of the most powerful assets towards a useful, happy, well-adjusted life. That kindness is not only a spiritual virtue, it is a philosophically demonstrable asset in daily living. Wherever unkindness develops, something is lost. Something is destroyed. Cruelty is a destroyer. And among the cruelties are criticism, condemnation, gossip, and all these destroying things. On the other hand, the kindness factor gives us a tremendous increase of acceptabilities. Our friends will be more happy with us. We will find more cheerfulness and calmness and beauty in life, because what we have ourselves, what we radiate, also affects, like a light, the environment in which we live. Now we come down to one of the most common and practical problems of all, and that is the effect of all these activities upon personal health. We are all desirous to be as well as possible for the span of time we are here. And we also know that there are cases in which a miserable character temperament can go on to be 110 years old. We cannot say always that the good die young. We cannot say that the evil all die young. But we can say with certainty that wherever evil conditions exist, the individual may be still physically alive, but he is dead as far as values are concerned. He is like the man who, of whom it was said, who was dead, but he did not know enough to lie down. Anyone whose life is destructive, critical, and is contributing nothing to the common good is already dead. And nature is going to work on him. Nature will produce a whole series of psychological ailments that are peculiar to persons with poor dispositions. These psychological ailments are fretfulness and irritation, criticism, condemnation. All of these elements all add up to a neurosis. And a neurosis is something that can be diagnosed. A neurosis, however, can never be successfully cured by medication. Why? Because the use of medication is an artificial means of trying to accomplish what the person should do himself. Nearly all hypnotic drugs and sedations attempt to substitute for an individual who is unable to be quiet of his own accord, who is unable to be patient or to clear his mind of problems which perhaps are not very real at best. But drugs cannot do this. They numb or dumb the quality for a moment, but they also destroy the life in the end. So the person who is inclined to sedation will find tranquility resulting from faith and affection, the best of all tranquilizers. He will find that when he is at peace with himself, he will not require the neurotic pressure ailment treatments. He will be able to live his own life in a quiet and peaceful way. As he goes along, of course, a cranky disposition and the loss of friends and all this type of thing can gradually undermine the normal, pleasant pleasures of life. They can hasten attitudes or conduct patterns which will produce sickness. They will also have a tendency to lower blood pressure, in some cases to a dangerous point. They will destroy and imbalance the endocrine system, and they will make marked destructive changes in blood chemistries and body functions. The nasty disposition is murderous. But instead of murdering other people, it is murdering itself. So everyone who has faults and criticisms and condemnations lurking in their nature will do well to try to root these things out by using the mind not to deny the existence of these conditions, but to transmute them into experience growth. Every fault is a lesson that must be learned. When learned, that lesson advances the eternal nature of the person. Every victory over the limitations or corruptions of nature is recorded in the permanent pattern of man's achievement. Therefore, try to balance off. Try to increase activities and interests. One reason people come to me and tell me about is that those who live too small a life are the ones who gradually develop most of the unpleasant infirmities. And very often they are defending these infirmities. They are making certain that people realize that these narrow lives are, in a mysterious way, especially blessed. There's something wonderful about being a neurotic. And sometimes other people really accept it as wonderful. But it may be a victory of the morbid over the normal, but it does not add anything to the permanent character of the person. Anyone who has a tendency to exaggerate the desire to escape contact with society is doing so because of ignorance. They do not understand society. Also, these people who don't understand are the ones that very often pass judgment upon everything. A person who has never done anything themselves always gives hearty advice to everyone else and advises things that have never been tried and won't work because they do not arise from experience but from prejudice. So a person who retires into themselves because of prejudice against worldliness is in trouble. It is far better for a person who is really religiously inclined to get out and work with constructive activities. According to the good book, the Lord created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. Now, according to our way of thinking, the works of the world are done in 6 days. And on the seventh day, we're all supposed to rest. Of course, under the present tensions, there's very little rest on the Sabbath. But at the same time, it is assumed that the seventh day is a day of rest, and that in our lives, each of us should have one day of quietude out of each week. One day of peace and consciousness and understanding and insight, joy, and secret benefits. That is a fair and proper separation. But when we try to make every day into a Sunday, then we're in trouble. We have 6 days in our own lives to get out and do things. And the seventh day is rest, which really tells us that about one-seventh of our time should be devoted, perhaps, to some type of special religious observance. The other six-sevenths should be devoted to living our religion out in the world and doing things. We should be able to prove our faith in our labors and not in our isolations. I do not find, and from experience and from reports that we get every day, that groups of people who try to get away from it all ever get very far. We find that if four people go off and form a group by themselves, there will be civil war within 6 months. People cannot do it. They're not supposed to do it. They are supposed to have a time set apart for religious observance, perhaps a time of quiet peace for self-analysis and an effort to restore our relationship with the infinite, which we all need. But if this is exaggerated too much and becomes a continuous process, it ultimately means that we, trying to get in touch with God, we lose touch with ourselves, our world, our society, and our families. We have to be practical in these things. And that means that most of the time, if we are not gainfully employed, because we have to be, we should be usefully employed doing things that help. For after all, the highest form of the religious life is service. There is no form of religion that is a substitute for serving each other in the name of the divine love. Just to love ourselves, love a few who agree with us, or go and constantly pray for divine insight, these things never have worked. The thing that works is to make a continuous religious experience out of practical usefulness, to go out and help other people in trouble, to go out and spread knowledge and help, to bring joy to the young, consolation to the old, and to constantly build into our own lives and hearts the joy of bringing joy to others. This is really the beginning of our religious life. It is the most important part of it. And without that, we are not very useful. To do this successfully, it is necessary for the person to mingle with other people, to gain insight into their interests, to learn arts, crafts, and trades by which we can create a link with other people and advance every type of useful knowledge. The first person who comes to us may be a bricklayer. The second may be a schoolteacher. The third may be a disillusioned minister. The fourth may be an artist who is having trouble with his techniques. Another is a broken home. Another is a child without parental guidance. All of these things come to us. And those things that come to us, we must meet. And the only way we can meet them is to understand life ourselves, to know how these people feel, to know what they have gone through, to know the problems that press upon them. And knowledge is based upon experience and upon facts. Therefore, if we really want to serve the spiritual mystery of life with full hope and full devotion, we must become as learned as possible in the practical services of each other. We must all have some way of contributing to the common good. And this is the basis of our happiness, it is the basis of our health, and it is the basis of our religion. Religion is finally and inevitably the continuing reminding of ourselves and others of the divine love and the divine plan. Religion is not something that is limited to a church. Religion is something that is unlimited. It is useful in every part of life. And the greatest sermon, the greatest meditation, is that which is devoted to the service of others. So in kindness and in service, and in the generous forgetting of ourselves in the name of God, we may find what we seek. For if we try to save our lives, we shall lose them. But when we lose our lives in the service of God, we have life everlasting. And in our service is our religion. In our service, we use everything that we know and can learn, and we learn more every day so that we can be more useful, realizing that the highest form that we have of religion is service, and that service demands the greatest possible area of personal experience. We must know all we can about as much as we can, as many different circumstances. We must view them all with patience, love, kindness, and thoughtfulness. And we must be prepared to meet the needs of other persons on their grounds, not on whatever prejudice we may have. So by becoming useful people, becoming pens in the hands of the ready writer, we serve others. We unfold our own religion, and because of our instinct to help others, we become more universally learned for our own good. The more we learn, the more we can live what we learn, and the more we share it with others. This, in fact, is the importance. We must diversify because we must serve. And the more different areas we have to call upon of knowledge, the better we can serve. Well, I guess that's all for today.